The theme for the evening talk is from the inner to the outer. In this long-standing tradition of the Dharma, there have been and continue to be many strands, many streams, which help and act as pointers to us to see into life and into the nature of existence as well and as clearly as we can. And these streams and pointers keep unfolding in a variety of ways. And some of that, of course, is being reflected in our days here. When I was a monk years ago, 25 years now since I disrobed, in the monastery we used to have what even to other monks in other streams and lineages looked like a rather peculiar exercise, and yet it had quite a lot of perceptive insight and wisdom that went along with it. And we would sit in the monastery in the meditation hall and in the grounds of it. And the exercise basically was the moving of the hand up and down like this. Not just for a minute or two, but for an hour at a time. And it was partly based on an extract from the talk of which all these insight meditation practices are in fact based on interpretation, when the Buddha said one is so mindful and so aware, one is aware of standing, walking, sitting, reclining, one is aware of chewing and swallowing the food, one is aware of turning one's head from left to right and right to left, he said, like the great elephant. And he said one is aware of urinating and defecating. And our teacher used to come and give mindfulness teachings on how to squat in the toilet and etc. from the beginning right through to the end, would give these demonstrations. Yes. Probably there are not many religious traditions that do that. And another was one is mindful and aware of the movement of the hand and what happens to the hand and where it goes, what we do with the hand. So we spent, and this was a daily practice of raising and moving the hand, very slow, moment to moment steps like this, and just directly feeling the vibrations and the sensations in the hand. So whenever one was in any other part of Thailand, and the first question that nearly always asked amongst monks of practice is, who is your teacher? And so I would say, oh, Ajahn Dharmadaro. And they say, oh, Ajahn Dharmadaro, oh yeah. This is Ajahn Dharmadaro, the one that swings the hand around, etc. And sometimes, just in the simple practical aspects of it, that in the movement of the hand, when one, as sometimes we are, get rather dozy and sleepy on the meditation cushion, I have to say, over the years I've had some extremely good naps sitting in this position, as some of you have noticed, and sometimes when that does, of course the hand kind of looks rather, you know, etc. And it's rather an indication that one's not quite present. But the more important aspect of this, and this is with regard to the inner to the outer and the flow, is that something happens between the inner life and some kind of direction that takes place, which moves through the body, goes out through the arm, out through the fingers, and out into the world. And therefore, if you and I just give a lot of care and attention, and I think this was the power and the benefit of this practice, to our hand, we might be able to see a very clear relationship between the hand and our inner life. And that, and following and tracking that movement is a part of what spiritual practice is about. And so sometimes, of course, that gets reflected in what we might describe as unhealthy, unwholesome kind of patterns, and the obvious sort of thing would be greed. And we're feeling, say, some greediness in the mind, or some insecurity, or whatever it might be, or what one must have and what I really want. And it runs out through, of course it involves the other senses, but there's a greed for getting, a grabbing, and the hands get used for that kind of purposes. You know, we want something, somebody else wants something in the same shop, in the same sale or whatever it is, and one races over there and grabs it. I've got it first. And it went right through the mind, right out through the fingers, with anger as well, another expression of ways that we anger builds up, and then it begins to run through the body, out through the hand, out through the fingers, and can show itself in, of course, aggression and violence, but in the using of the fist, tension, so forth. And of course, when we're confused and in state of delusion, etc., and worried or anxious, sometimes nervous or guilt feelings. Sometimes we catch all of this, and then we find ourselves nervous or worried or feeling concerned or guilty about something, and hands moving around the body, it's scratching itself all over the place, because we're very uncomfortable about something, and that uncomfortableness has run out through the hands again, and it's finding its location in all sorts of ways. So sometimes the unhealthy is flowing out through, and can we catch it and work with it before it actually flows out into the world, when it's unhealthy and unwholesome? And some things which are healthy and wholesome, to recognize that flow and, as it were, the antidote to greed would be generosity and acts of giving, in all the ways that that can flow out into the world and to show and express itself. Anger can be transformed, or we develop loving kindness, and that can show itself as acts of kindness and support. And I'm sure we've all known the situation where just writing of a letter, sending of an email, a warm hand on somebody who's going through distress, how supportive and comforting that is. And that's again the heart moved through the body, out through the fingers, and into the world at large, or with creativity as well. And in that, expressions and forms of creativity that come, many ways to express it, of course. One is out through the body. So the deeper we actually go inside, and the clearer we are inside, the clearer we can see this movement and its ways and its manifestations outwardly. And part of our practice in the relative world, part of our practice in the relative world, is a real looking at what's going from inner to outer, and that we never forget all problems in the world, in humanity, amongst men and women in the world, start in one place, the mind. They don't start anywhere else, they actually start in the mind. That's the origin of all human problems that we deal with, both about ourselves and others, is because of minds, and the way minds, including feelings and emotions, meet other minds. And the body is often a real mirror and a real reflection of telling us and telling others who we are. And I remember my good abbot, Ajahn Damodaro, it was about a 30 meter walk from the entrance to the monastery to his hut, which where he could meet in one room, could meet about 20 guests or 20 or 30 guests. guests, and he would sit there, and by the way that the person was walking into the monastery, he would just observe them walking in and the manner of the walking in. And sometimes he would sit, and sometimes I'd have the translator there, and he would give a description of this person's personality just by their 30-minute walk. And they used to come and sit down, and actually he was nearly always right. We used to go, whoa, because we're just walking advertisements in our manner for what's going on inside. And if people came in happy and clear and steady, they came in with a speedy mind, they came in anxiously, they came in agitated, or whatever, or they just came in, and sometimes we could barely read the body language. But he got so used to it after 20 years in the monastery of just observing people walking towards his hut, and he just give what the state of mind was going on with the person. So as I say, the inner runs, as it were, through the cells of the body, keeps running outwardly, and it's not for us to be speculating or judging or becoming analysts of what's going on with others. But what is important to see what is inner and what's going outwardly. And I think in the time and the culture that we live in, we need more ways of looking, and sometimes it might just be that we might take one aspect and feature of our life, and sometimes that can be in a way summarized in a way. Sometimes love much, want little. And sometimes we just take something very simple and we say, I'm going to take this seriously. Love much, want little. And just take a theme and really take it to heart and really live with it and really ask oneself, how can that express itself in life? And if we take something like that, or any other which feels appropriate for you, then that can get the opportunity to run very deep, and so deep that there'll be a response to it, and that response to it is that we'll actually want less. And I'm not only talking about wanting less in consumer culture, which is vitally important because our capital, that is our earth, can't stand for much longer the kind of exploitation of resources just to feed the greed, the desire, the pursuit of luxury goods and wealth and status symbols like bigger houses and new cars and more prosperity itself, which is costing others their livelihoods, their lives sometimes, in the unfairness. And our culture has to look at that and to see, that means you and I, to see what it would mean to really have a real life commitment to wanting less. Because it shows itself when we don't attend to that. It will show itself in, as I said earlier, in all manner of ways that we speak about life, what we talk about with others, and are we constantly talking about what we want? Or are we really going to refer and look at and see what does it mean, and the huge challenge for us to love much, want little. And that may begin to manifest and show itself just in our real way of being in the world. Sometimes in that working with ourselves and expanding of ourselves as we're doing in the meditations here, and the sitting posture and the walking postures, whether we sit in the chair or kneeling or cross-legged, is of course to strengthen the capacity to be as quickly and as early as possible aware of what is coming from within and what's going out. To be aware as quickly as possible. That's why we practice so carefully, to be aware what's within and what's coming out, and to say that which is within, which one knows is worthwhile and valid and beneficial, let it flow freely, absolutely, no inhibitions on it. And that which flows out into the world and one knows is destructive for people and environment, let's really work on it both individually and together to really change something fairly dramatically with ourselves. I remember in the monastery, when I first went to the monastery, I was a young man, I was only in my mid-twenties at that time, in a rather, speaking to one of the staff here earlier in the week, feeling rather a little bit isolated from all the conventions of things, the only Westerner in the province, and being a monk as well. And when the meal times came, basically the abbot sat at the end, the teacher, and then it was just two rows of monks, and the food was in the middle, and we sat cross-legged. And when I went into the monastery, that my legs were not like they are now; they were up here like butterflies, you know. And it was so tight, because I'd never sat cross-legged in my life before. It was so tight up here that I could barely get my arms between my legs to get to the food, and I was kind of poised on my bit of my butt here, constantly concerned that I'd fall backwards like this, or fall over the side there. And the monks never, you know, some of the monks, it was the first time they actually met a Westerner really out in the sticks in nowhere, and would walk over and just touch the knees. I said, be careful, don't push. No, just touch. And they, and Nagasena, who was the Indian monk, my translator, told me once that monks have been discussing this, and they're convinced I have a severe physical handicap. And for them it was. They'd never encountered, they'd seen this, had a bad road accident or something. And one finds it was just like rock. But then with movement and exercise and practice and encouragement through the yogas and things like that, things which seem like never move, never go anywhere. You could hit the knees with an iron, they wouldn't have moved. So that movement just gradually, and the cellular life begins to expand and open out. And I think, in a way, it's kind of as a fact, but metaphorically as well, with our mind and with our heart, we can be closed. And as one person said today in the small group, she for a period of time had felt quite angry with a number of people, and anger of course is a contracted state of mind, and very much touched by the power of loving kindness meditations and Tinaka and Stephen, many of you know, gave loving kindness. And Stephen said to me at tea time, oh, we did it together. And my first thought was they did it in unison, you know, the two of them like in a choir, but apparently not. But some one did and the other followed. But anyway, and sometimes in our contraction, sometimes it is a genuine expansion. And so this person said, for 8 months, regularly, daily, she did her loving kindness meditation. And then gradually that began to expand out the heart, expand out the mind, and found afterwards the anger and all that had gone along with it had gone, because that expansion had gone, had come to that, and the contraction had fallen away. And we do need, in this going from the inner to the outer with ourselves, that the two features which are so important for us, if we are to work on ourselves as human beings and to sustain the work, the two important features, one is the cultivation of calmness and heartfulness, these two go together, go together, and that we might look upon as an important and sustainable practice there. And the other is insight, and that insight may come through quite spontaneously. We just see clearly, and the seeing clearly cuts into something, it changes something. And if it's a genuine insight, it genuinely has some lasting influence. Sometimes, even in a retreat situation, like we're here where the receptivity is high, you and I, in all that we've attended to in the days together, may not know at this moment what the insights are. This is an extraordinary thing with deep things of life. So in other words, in the time of listening, some of you may say, well, I've heard of this insight meditation, I've been here for 5 days and I'm none the wiser, I haven't had a single insight since I've been here, and I'm still at the still in the practice of cultivating some kind of relationship with my knees, and this is what the 5 days has been all about for me. And some people haven't found their knees to even start the relationship. So, and though that may be the case over the days that one is here, sometimes with insight, it's actually later on. Later on, something that arose in your mind, maybe as a single, simple thought. And one didn't think of it as an insight at the time, just had a thought about something. Or it may be something that you listen to in an inquiry. It may be something that you just observe, that which is around you. And sometimes that has registered so well and so deeply, far more so than one thought or felt in the time. And therefore, as you and I work, we are constantly working in a rather limited field of consciousness. Limited field of consciousness called what's going on with the breath. Limited field, what's going on in the body. What's going, observing of the thought, listening to the sound. And it's just small particulars out of life that we're attending to. And it's a rather small world. Actually, just a sound, or just a breath, or just a sensation. Yet, unknown to ourselves, there is a lot more going on. And there's a tremendous amount that's flowing from the outer to the inner, and there's a tremendous amount which is flowing from the inner to the outer. And sometimes that flow is such that the insight is when it's coming from the inner and going to the outer. That means we're meditating, we're calm, we're still, we're doing our practice, and in that the insight comes through that way. Sometimes the insight, the clarity, comes the other way. You're listening, it's coming from the outer to somebody's voice, small group, one-to-one inquiry or whatever, and something in the listening, it registers well, it touches one, and one sees the simple, rather pure truth of it. And if it's registered well, maybe in the moment or maybe later, it becomes a real resource. One sees, knows and feels the benefit of it. And sometimes it's inner and outer working together, especially in dialogue form. Two people working together, looking at something together, that's been going on in the small groups with Tinica, Stephen and I, and in the dialogue that's going on, the inner and the outer meeting together, and there's a spark, it's a catalyst, and there's an insight. And one feels a gratitude or appreciation or a recognition, and one sees, ah, that's just right, that's, I see it more clearly now. And those moments of seeing things more clearly is what insight is, what the function of our meditation is. And the more that you and I take an interest, the world offers endless, infinite and immeasurable possibilities for insight. We live in a field for insight, and consciousness responds to it extraordinarily well. And therefore, inner to outer, outer to inner, genuinely is part of the process. And as I said a moment or two ago, that sometimes in the listening, it may be days, weeks, months, years. And as people have been telling me over the many years now, you know, sometimes very kindly, they said, you know, because something that you said in a talk 10 years ago, I thought it went straight over my head. And I thought, what the hell is this guy talking about? Etc. You've probably had it all week. And then somehow in the changing, unfolding conditions, the person said, now I understand. Now it's come clear. Etc. And sometimes it's the listening, and then you go home and then you read something in a book, and you've read it before, you've read the same thing, but now the reading's got a whole new meaning to it, a whole new significance to it. Book hasn't changed, words on the paper are still the same, but your depth has changed. The depth has changed. And we don't know how it is for us. We don't know just how deep we are. But the insights and the appreciations and the interest, all of that is the confirmation of men and women going deeper. And that depth doesn't have an end to it. It's infinite. Endless possibility. And this gives many of us the real joy of life, of this ongoing, endless exploration, and in a way which is extraordinarily freeing. In our exploration from the inner to the outer, in the tradition, Buddhist tradition here, the Buddha has stated and reminded, there is one truth, one truth, truth is truth, without a second. There are not many different truths, but of course, both scientifically and philosophically and religiously, people agree or disagree over the various truths. And some, as we know, in those communities and in the Buddhist world as well, make a lifestyle out of arguing over who's right. The difficulty with all of this is the conviction that can go with it. An extraordinary thing is that there is more in common than what separates. When things are going from the inner to the outer, we're expressing our views. We put them in our letters, we put them in our emails. Some of them have the madness to put them in books as well. And once something has gone from the inner, down the arm and out into the paper, or even worse, onto the email these days, you know, people just press forward. And I've probably had the same. I've sent an email to somebody, and I'm getting emails from all around the world. Christopher, I just had an email that you sent out, just been forwarded to me. I'd really like to just talk about this with you, or email back and forth with you about anything. Yeah. So these days, from the inner, movement takes place, manifesting as views and opinions, and it would appear that we have people, well, in common with our views and opinions, and we have people who agree with some, and we have people who disagree, and we have people, whoever we are, who think we're completely off the wall, totally out to lunch, and how could the mind ever think that that view and opinion has any truth in it? And so it is us as human beings, inner moving to the outer, But what we forget, how much closure and cutting and dividing goes on through that movement. How it fragments human beings, how it sets up divisions, and those divisions can only take place through a movement of the mind which takes a view and opinion as the truth, and it is unable to distinguish. And it's the great tragedy of our existence that we confuse truth with a view and opinion about anything. And because we can make this confusion, then of course we have the conflict, which is always bound up with two different views and opinions. Can't have conflict unless there's two different views and opinions which disagree, and sometimes violently disagree. And some of you here have been speaking to me. There may be two different perceptions and views and opinions in the same household. I'm not talking big scale here, you know, just down to earth, you know, at the kitchen table, nothing too dramatic. And yet the two views, opinions, carry with it an absolute sense is invested into it, I am right. One could say, to take an example, if one said, here's a bell, and I ring it, probably most of us, unless we've had a especially difficult retreat, would say, yes, that was a bell, and you just rang it. You know, most people probably agree that's a great view and opinion. But another human being, for whatever reason, may just want to cause trouble, may want to make one's life difficult and start arguing that it isn't a bell whatsoever, and there's no sound coming out of it, why claim it? That's what it is. And both can argue till the cows come home. And in Britain, there are not many left. But anyway, and the difficulty is the conviction that each holds that each are right. The conviction is that there's that one is right, and of course that conviction can build and build. And there is a forgetting in that movement from inner to outer, that movement in this case, not through the hand, maybe through writing, but coming up through the body, out up through the throat, and out through speech as language. That movement, as it goes from the inner to the outer, what is forgotten is that the two parties, let's say it's two persons, what they have in common is the same thing. Both are clinging to the view and opinion. Both think they're right. The two people have more in common than what separates them. They're closer by their feeling, closer by their attitude, closer by the intention, and closer by the position. I am clinging to my opinion, I can't stand yours. And so if we can track ourselves back to the movement, could it be that if we're willing to do that inwardly, that we won't be kind of compartmentaling life into another division of those who agree with us and those who disagree about anything? And therefore, to track back is somehow implies for us some kind of movement of the heart, for one thing, to open the heart out, a movement of the mind to really acknowledge what's going on with us, our clinging and our holding from the inner to the outer, and that can start to break down the doors of division. sometimes, again, not a, not unusual situations where one takes up the view might be to support and protect people who are talking with a person today, situations where people have been harmed or hurt or badly treated, in all the ways that can happen in domestic violence situation is the one that I got in mind. And one's heart reaches out for the person on the receiving end of that. It's a terrible tragedy. And when one reads in the West that something like one in four women at some time are subjected to domestic violence in Europe. You know, it's a terrible tragedy that's going on. But how easily, from that care and concern, support, or working with, it can easily leave an image which says, in this case, men are like this, and this happens to women, and there's a fragmentation. And of course, that alienation, and it is only alienation, which can inflict harm on other people. One has to be cut off from them emotionally, in a deep way, and with awareness and sensitivity and understanding. One has to be cut off from all of that for the reaction or the rage to come through. So it's vital and important for us in our working from the inner to the outer to see how that comes out through body, how that comes out, in this case, as I said, through the arm, how that comes out through the written, how that comes out through speech, and that's part of a human response ability, to be able to respond. And all of this in Dharma language is called dealing with the relative world, or in our language here, dealing with everyday life, dealing with how we experience things. Even if in the exploration of the inner to the outer and the outer to the inner, we became rather, hopefully, insightful with regard to this and rather wise in what's coming to us and how to deal with it, and what's coming out of us and through us and how to attend to that wisely. From the standpoint of the Dharma, it wouldn't be enough. Even if our life is well integrated and we are genuinely leading a creative life in the many ways that we can be creative in life, the heart of the Dharma is to discover the essence of all of this. Where does the inner and the outer spring from? Because both spring and emerge from something deeply in common. And this we forget. So we're often spellbound by the differences. I am like this, you are like that. Hopefully our views can shared and we can be in harmony with each other because we share common views and common ethics and things like that. Hopefully our love of expression of life and activity and creativity and all the diversity and differences, all that matters, but from what does it come? And therefore it's a sensing or a finding of the source, the essence of things. I think one or two of you here have the name Sara. Sara in Pali language means essence. One is here to find the essence of things. And therefore, though we track back and we say, aha, there's the movement of mind, there's the views and opinions, it keeps revealing how much we have in common, views are views, opinions are opinions, whatever they're about. Then we see the feeling and the contact. But where does it all rest? What's the emergence of it? And that, as we have touched upon a little bit with our days here together, is that a certain kind of silence in which we rest. A certain kind of silence in which the relative world, or the conventional world, the everyday world, which is called inner to outer and outer to inner, doesn't matter to us. though very much in everyday life, what's coming to us matters a great deal to us. What's coming from us matters a great deal to us. And we're very much involved in the outer to the inner, and the inner to the outer, as if that's all that there is. It isn't. It isn't. It's like saying there are waves and no ocean. It's like saying there's a great lake, which you're not familiar with here, and no water in it. It's like saying there's only trees, but sorry, there's no wood. Now, sometimes we get so fascinated with the differences, inner to outer, outer to inner, we've concluded that life is that. That's all it is about. And it's a misunderstanding, it's a forgetfulness, it's a neglect, it's a lack of inquiry, it's a loss of interest in from where it all springs. And so we've touched upon here that which we've been calling consciousness here, that which we can refer to as something which doesn't have any measure to it, and what the Buddhists have called, of course, is emptiness. And when people first hear the word emptiness, often the initial response to hearing the word emptiness is, cool. Who'd want that? I feel empty enough already. So, but what's significant is it's a kind of way, and I know in the tradition here, that somehow or other it's as though by necessity we have to leave everything behind, not go anywhere, but leave everything behind, so that in the silence of things, all the characteristic is a sight, the characteristic is colour, sounds, sound waves, the smell, the taste, the touch, and they are just characteristics. And the characteristics come to that which has no characteristic, because it reveals it. It comes to that which has no characteristic. If it came to something which didn't have, which had a characteristic, there'd be such a confusion, what's what? But we know a sight is a sight. A sound is a sound, a smell is a smell, a taste is a taste, a thought is a thought, state of mind is a state of mind, etc. And it comes to that which has no characteristic, which the Buddhists and others call emptiness, empty of any characteristic. If the sense for that and the love of that, that in an extraordinary way, that which has no characteristic makes everything possible. Everything. Everything from the furthest star to the beautiful galaxies of the night, to the sweetness of the touch of the moment, and even to the difficult and the hard and the rough and the smooth and the joyful and the distressing and the painful and all that goes on in this world. The sheer diversity of all those characteristics of existence that we are all too familiar with is made possible by the emptiness which reveals it, which is not a characteristic. And sometimes we wonder, extraordinary thing this. If it's got no characteristic, can't be born, because once there's a birth, there's a characteristic of birth. Can't be aging, because it has a characteristic of aging. It can't die because they have a characteristic of death. Can't get bigger, can't get smaller, because it would tell us, that we could see that. So this is an extraordinary thing which is called emptiness, which is called nirvana, which is called the truth that makes all things possible, which is called the Buddha nature, which is called God, which is called the immeasurable, which is called the stable, which is called the unchanging. All of that, that ought to be a great interest for us as men and women on the earth to sense that, to which the saints and the mystics and the sages have never tired of referring and talking to in various languages and non-languages as well. And then we might say, how would one as a human being know if one had discovered it? Not just as some of you have reported, some taste of perhaps, which is very important and extraordinarily significant, more so than what you may realize, not just in terms of appreciation of and a recognition of, but if it's really clear to us. The Buddha's breathtaking analogy for what that means for it to be really clear to us, he said, one who really knows emptiness which makes all things possible, or if we put it in the religious language, one who knows what it is to be with God, knows it as well as a person knows colour who has good eyesight. Knows it as well, we might say, as that our hand is on the end of our arm. Knows it that well. And the expression, the outcome of that knowing, we could say the characteristic coming out of that for a human being, the kind of, you could say, confirmation, is that one knows, one is extraordinarily free. And therefore shares that in common with the way things are. This great universe is so free, it's so free, it allows all of this. And doesn't care a damn whether you and I like it or not. It's so free, it permits all of this. And a human being can share in that freedom of diversity. And so free that birth, aging, pain and death cannot take it away. Because what can be taken away has a characteristic to it. And it's that immediate. And therefore, as the Buddha has said, when asked, what is the doorway, he asked for this. And he's given different replies. And he said, what is the doorway to this? And he says, the doorway is this liberation through non-clinging. And he's asked, what is the doorway to this? And another time he says, it's a liberation through the here and now. Many ways that help to communicate something which accommodates the inner and the outer. And I think even if we, you know, people say to me, oh, I doubt all of this, Christopher, I'm not so sure. And could be right, could be wrong, etc. And I can't relate to any of this. And I mean, why should I take any notice of a 3,000-year-old tradition and whatever? Why should I take any notice of these teachers from around the world of different traditions have expressed this? And non-traditions express this in different ways, and perfect right to actually do that. I never concern myself with the views and opinions about whether people believe it or not. I just believe. I'm much more interested in people's awareness, willingness to look into things. And even if that means having to live lots and lots of times with lots and lots of doubts, which are various views and opinions, and they're just arising in the mind, Just look at them. Just another thing that's arising in the mind. It's not saying anything about anything. How could it? It's empty. It's just a funny old view and opinion rising out of the brain cells, probably because one is a little agitated about something, and it just pops out. And so therefore it doesn't say anything about anything, other than it's just a view and opinion. So this sense of that, and you know, simple recognition of what is, that even if one holds rather tightly to it, doesn't matter. It won't change the nature of things. That nothing that could happen will make it more true or less true or whatever. It just manifests.